We're going to try to draw some ideas about how some of the methods of prayer we talked about earlier this week are played out in our ministry and everyday life, and hope also that you all will share how your prayer life plays itself out in very practical ways in your ministry. Because I think that's something that we don't necessarily look at enough in our lives, because we're so busy doing that we forget that there's something else underneath and around all that we're about.
We forget about being who we are and who we ought to be, who we're meant to be.
And about the ground of being, the ground of all being.
As we've said before, our view about this topic is a particularly personal one, and maybe an idiosyncratic one. We certainly don't think we know everything there is to know about prayer and contemplation. We have tried to engage in prayer and contemplation as part of our lives, and sometimes, at least I personally feel that I do that more than others. I'm more successful at times. But in a lot of ways, our ideas are coming out of what we do and what our experience is. We use a praxis perspective. Praxis is, I think, originally Greek word for action. So the idea is to do something and then to reflect on it and see what it means and where it leads you. Because of that, our ideas are always tentative and in process, and we'd like to share them with you and to get your response as part of the process. We work in some of the most damaged social and political and economic systems that we know of right now. We're in the inner city of Chicago, working with homeless people, marginally housed people, mentally ill people. And one of the fruits of prayer and contemplation, I think, as well as one of the fruits of that kind of work, is that we see God's creation in those very damaged and marginalized places and people. To me, one of the key issues about living a prayerful life is how to take prayer into every day, or how to have it carry you in everyday life. And that's pretty much what we're talking about tonight. The question is not just how you open your heart to God when you're in a quiet, peaceful, supportive, nurturing setting, but how you stay open to God in the midst of chaos and doing the laundry and preparing your lectures and finding a resource for somebody who comes in off the street and has no place to stay or needs medical care or whatever. So it's like, how do you continue to pay attention and be aware of the sacred and what you really want to be about, and continue to erode your own preconceptions, your own preset agendas in the midst of everything else. We've talked this week about three methods of contemplation that we've found helpful. Centering prayer and silence, sung prayer and chant, and
welcome to come to the table if you like.
And being in relationship on a spiritual level. And tonight we will talk about how these practices may spill over into times when we don't know that we're praying or contemplating or meditating. Could really sit up here and work.
That's right.
Not usually dangerous.
That's right.
Especially after breakfast.
That's right.
Gets a lot better after breakfast.
I think the major theme, really, of the week, and again, we're going to sort this, try to sort this out in our own heads and put words around it, is that we further learn how to predispose ourselves to God's presence in our lives and the movement of Spirit in our lives. And we think that the people in the Christian tradition, the mystical tradition, have a lot to offer us. Mystics have gotten a bad rap and as being kind of, you know, off in the ozone someplace. But we think in many ways that the mystics in our tradition are really the practical folks who offered us some ways to understand prayer that we can bring into our everyday life in very helpful ways. And so one of the things that we're one of our tentative ideas is that how we spend our attention is critical in our lives. And how, you know, at a gross level, it's kind of like I was talking to some folks earlier, but how much time do you spend watching the news on TV versus how much time do you spend doing stuff? In other words, how many hours of shows have you watched on TV, and have I watched on TV about homelessness, versus how many hours have we spent with hands-on work with homeless people? Now, in this group, it's probably this is probably preaching to the converted, but I think that's a piece of it. And some people talk about what they call consensus trance, saying that in our culture we're kind of not really fully awake, and that we're. But I don't want to push those things. I just think that what we're trying to look at here and what's been helping us is realizing that starting in our prayer life, starting with opening up kinds of prayer, predisposes us to be more available in the path of service to others in our ministries. In other words, starting there really helps in many ways deal with situations that I wouldn't be able to deal with if I weren't involved in setting a prayer. In other words, if I weren't able to see, because what happens with centering prayer, which is this prayer of silence that comes out of the contemplative tradition, where I watch my thoughts kind of churning up and watch what's going on, and there's a sacred word that I use to kind of help bring myself back to the center, to signal my intention to go deeper in relationship with God, that I see what's carrying me away, what my agendas are. And we all have them, folks. And that's part of attention, too. Simone Weil talks about the fact that attention, she thinks in all education, one of the most important things that's trained in like mathematics is attention, is sustained attention, is sustained staying with, is not being carried away by this kind of internal kind of, you know, melodrama that we've got going on inside of us. Because if we've got that going on, how can we be available to the other if we're attending to our own, you know, kind of, and I said earlier about the fact that one of the things that's very painful about doing this is to start realizing how a lot of the melodrama is kind of rewriting your own history. So we're not kind of rewriting the history of George, making me sound a lot better off than I really am. And so I start finding out that, you know, when I start noticing my immediate reactions to things, that I'm not such a swell guy a lot of the time. Okay, my responses are not such. But at any rate, I think the issue here is that it provides additional openness to the other in service, to the community, and, you know, and to God, and, you know, and the leading of this, the leading of God. And a lot of friends of mine saying, you know, George, you're very much obedient to God's will because of the fact I've done lots of kind of crazy things over the last few years, and it's not the way it feels inside to me. What feels inside to me is that God has offered opportunities. To be doing things have been very wonderful in my life. But I think what I'm talking about here is this method of silent prayer and other methods that you may find helpful in life. Where it begins to spill over in everyday life is it's like taking my spiritual temperature. I mean, it's like when I'm in silence in the mornings, I can kind of, I have a sense of what's going to really be getting me that day. Because what comes up is, you know, what am I anticipating here? You know, now I'm anticipating, we're anticipating leaving tomorrow. So it's like, which isn't particularly interesting to anyone, I suspect. But what I'm saying is,
It may not even be interesting to us.
But the point is it helps to kind of bust some of my agendas. So there's more room there. Thomas Keating talks about the fact that our thoughts are like kind of boats on a river, and they're kind of guttle to guttle, and you can't see the river. You know, and as you spend more time in silent prayer, you begin to see space between the boats, which is the presence of God. I mean, God is the river that sustains us. But if we've got all this kind of chatter going on the surface, there's not the opening to God's presence. There's not the opening to seeing God in the presence of the other in service. So we talk a lot about this one of the best we talk about is tithing, which is being spiritually present, deeply present in the other. In our community, since we do a lot of mission work, we call it mission in reverse, which means we encourage other people who are generally in a power down position. I got all kinds of degrees behind my name and stuff, and so people I'm with are in one down position to me. And so one of the ways I can help to erode that kind of this is to really deeply encourage the other person to be my teacher. And let me tell you, folks, the homeless and the poor have a lot to teach us. But that's this kind of business of opening, because some things they're going to be teaching me, I'm not going to want to know. There's some chairs over here if you have some plenty.
That's where to be.
One of you has to sit here, though. Okay? That's not the deal.
There's
the
chairs over there. There's a table to sit on.
That's right.
You've got to get your chair up.
All over there. That's right. That's right.
We're just going to
sit on the natural place for you.
That's
you
right.
Imagine.
That's true, that's right.
We'll play a picture of the people back in the seminary and we'll never let you hold
them. That's right. That's right.
I think there's another way to think about this business of the ongoing chatter and the ongoing agendas and the ways we talk to ourselves all the time without even realizing it, and that is that it's very helpful to have our attention right here where we are right now. And to the extent that we're talking to ourselves about what happened 10 minutes ago or last night or 2 weeks ago or what's going to happen tomorrow and if we're going to make the bus on time and can we get sheets and stuff like that and make our bed, to the extent that we're doing all that stuff, we're not paying attention to what's here right now. And in a real sense, the present moment is the only one we ever have. And if we're always attending to what's going to happen tomorrow or what happened yesterday, we can miss our whole lives. You know? And I think part of being spiritually present to the other is really paying attention right now to the person that you're with. Rather than thinking, gee, I've got to remember to put baking soda on my list for the grocery. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I think about a lot. My gosh, I'd forgotten baking soda for 2 weeks.
And what's happened for us after a period of time is what's kind of come up is kind of somebody sitting on my shoulder, it's kind of a part of me that's observing the other part of me. Whereas as the attention becomes more focused in the present, it's kind of a divided attention. And there's one part of me that's kind of being with and doing, and there's another part of me that's watching me being with and doing, and watching what's kind of staying in the way of my being more involved or less involved. It's hard to describe it because it's a split kind of attention. It's very helpful. And let me give you kind of an example of how this plays out very practically. Part of my work is to do street ministry, and although I spend most of my time currently today working in single room occupancy hotels where people were one step up from the street, I still spend some time on the street getting to and from and doing other things. I always wear a clerical collar, and I did it from the start, and most people call me Father George because that's what happens when you wear a clerical collar, although I say I'm a UCC minister, but that's the way it is. But part of it, I mean, the reason that I wore it was a feeling, first of all, advertised, and there's someone from the church present. There's a lot of transients in this neighborhood, and so a lot of folks know me, I wouldn't need to otherwise, but a lot of people don't know me. And also, I have some feeling of safety. I mean, I hope it gives me some kind of feeling of safety for folks that feel like I put on much money. They're going to get a lot of heat on them if they mess with me, because the police will probably give them a harder time if they mess with a clergy person and like that. But the one fear I have is a lot of people who are on the street who are mentally ill are very angry at the church, many of them. They've got kind of delusional stuff about religion and so one of the fears I've had is I'm going to run into somebody who is really delusional and very angry at the church, and is going to act that out on me. And again, what I can tell you is that's what I've said in the past has been, it's like being a walking Rorschach inkblot test, because people project onto me what they think about the church. Okay, and what's been one of the gifts that people have given me is a lot of the feelings they have were feelings I had too. And so they say, I'm really angry about the way that, you know, people, you know, talk one thing and do another in the church. And I say, well, I'm angry about that too. And so, and they say, whoa, wait a second, here's this person who I think I'm going to know what the response is, and they're concerned about it. But what I found is I've detoxified. I mean, I reentered the church in a deeper way because, I mean, my conversion process was from the poor. And the poor converted me to go more deeply into the church. So that's all by way of background to talk about kind of the way of being on the street. And it took a long time before people began to trust me. But always working in my back, and I know that probably, I don't know, 15% of people are carrying guns in the party. There may be more than that, a lot more than people than that are carrying other weapons. I mean, the drop-in centers have metal detectors and the whole routine. I mean, literally, before they had them, I was in there one day, there was a cop just sweeping the street, and it was like, it was just like a cutlery shop. I mean, people would haul stuff into this center off the street, all these knives and package knives, I mean, it was all kind of, anyway. So I know a lot of people are armed, and so it's a pretty wild place, but anyway, one day I was walking down the street, and there's a cluster of folks who were kind of on a street corner, and there's a woman who was obviously very disturbed who was in this cluster of folks. And I came up within about 10 feet of her, all of a sudden the crowd kind of parts, and she starts making eye contact with me and talking in a very kind of loud voice and kind of very disturbed. She has a gun pointed at me. So I started going through all my kind of survival stuff about what am I going to do, where we got this. And I noticed that it's not a real gun. It's a very accurate replica. But I'm on my way by that point. And I mention this because, later reflecting, and I wish I could stay with her. I could stay with her and say to her, look, This is not a smart thing to be doing with you. I mean, if a police officer sees you, you get shot. But part of the reason that I wasn't able to be with her was because this was playing into my fantasy about and my fear, kind of one of my really deepest fears about what might happen. And so I wasn't able to stay with her. I'm not racked with guilt about this by any means, because I do the best I can. But what I'm trying to say is, I think by kind of having that kind of awareness, it predisposes me to be able to stay with people a bit better. I think the other dance that we're called to do, and I know many of you are too, in a very broken place, is that a minority of folks are so damaged that they are predatory on other folks. And so part of the dance is to be with those people and not be prey to them. Because if you have a rep on the street of being a mark, I mean, that's it. I mean, you don't get any respect from anybody. If you're a sucker, I mean, people will line up to get you. But on the other hand, how do you get beyond that? Because, I mean, I've talked with folks who see some of the folks who panhandle. I know, I'm sure you're all in the panhandle. And I've seen people go through about 5 different routines, okay, until they got the one to hit. And again, you know, it's funny in a way, but also it's like this way people make a living. I mean, it's the way they survive, and some people have gotten very good at it. But the question is how do you get through that to the true self, to the human being that's so layered with these kind of shells of manipulation. And again, I was walking down the street about a year ago or so, and a guy came up to me and said, I need $4 for bus fare. And I said to him, where are you going? Peoria? You're going a long ways for $4. And so we started talking, and he was talking to me a long story about what happened, a very difficult thing. And finally, said, will you give me enough money for bus fare to get bus in that place? And by that point, I could tell that the guy was a little intoxicated. He was a little intoxicated. I said, I won't give you any bus fare. And so the guy said, he said, if Jesus were here, he'd give me bus fare. And so I said to him, I said, my friend, I can smell alcohol in your breath. And if I give you money, you're probably going to buy more alcohol, and it's not going to help you. There's a detox center that's 3 blocks from here. And I'll walk you over there, get you checked into the detox, clean yourself up in the detox, and then we'll see what we can do to help some of the things happen. And then he wasn't ready to do that, and we had a long conversation. And I gave him my card, and I said, when you're ready to take the next step, here's my card. I have my new home number on. We just moved. I have the old home number on. So people call me at lots of different hours right there.
We get some very interesting phone calls.
Yes. But this fellow wasn't ready to do that. And so we kind of say our goodbyes. And he walks away. He says, he turns around and says, he says, if Jesus were here, he wouldn't have been. So at some level, I think, We got to another kind of place together, is all I'm saying. But that's part of the dance. So part of the dance, in Walter Wink's kind of terminology, is to try to be transformed with one another, not to be doormats, not to be aggressive and build a shell, but to continue to try to open ourselves even in very difficult circumstances. We get criticism in our church because everything's locked up. When we aren't there. But the reality is, if things aren't locked, there's nothing there in a week from now. And we don't have the people to be there, to be with folks in the community. I mean, we'd love to have our sanctuary open all the time, but we don't have the people power to do that. So we're always called to be in this dance and be as wise as we can, kind of living around the edge ourselves. But I think part of this is before I go out on the streets, I always spend some time in silent prayer. I ask God to guide me, and I'm there for a bit before I go out. And oftentimes I'm on the street walking, and people aren't. I'm not having connection with folks directly. I'll be in prayer, and there's a pace. I mean, it's like a way that I walk. I walk very slowly. There's an invitational way of walking in the street, and on and on, that really, a lot of people connect, and it's been very wonderful. I think it's difficult to describe this sometimes, but it's a very wonderful experience, and it's one of really being very blessed. It's a cliche to say that people give you more than you can give them. But that's the way this works. That's the way this process works. It's not I mean, the gifts that people have given me in Uptown, I can't possibly give them back. Can't possibly. But that's not what it's about. It's kind of, you know, telling you who's given who the most gifts. I think it's learning to really be with one another and learning to encourage one another to go deeper on that journey. Now, I want to say a little bit about discernment, because one of the difficulties with starting with religious experience is, you know, is this God speaking to me or is it the devil? I mean, you know, a lot of people have lots of powerful experience, but it's like, you know, really, you know, it's not so helpful sometimes. And I think part of this is to say that the major part of Nancy and my work is being embedded in three different communities of faith. And we belong to an ecumenical community dedicated to mission, to our own church, and then to the seminary community. Our deepest source of support is our ecumenical-based Christian community that we belong to. And that group is a group of folks who are a community of accountability and support. And it's very interesting. It's a very soft way of being supportive, because the way that we witness to one another is telling our stories. So when we get together for worship a couple times a month, part of our time together is to go around and check in and have people tell their stories. And it's like when we hear what other friends of ours are doing, other community members in other parts of the world, as well as the United States, and see what challenges that they're facing, and kind of how the stuff that we're doing is a step along the way for us, but you know, where we aren't taking maybe as many risks as they are. No one says to the other person, you know, why aren't you taking more risk? But just by kind of being together and sharing our stories, we kind of open up parts of ourselves that we couldn't do otherwise. And that's extremely helpful. And I think the other part is reflecting about, you know, what kind of a person am I? Am I behaving more like, behaving more like the way Jesus behaved in his public ministry? Or less? Is the gap? Is the community being developed? Is the community being supported by what we do? Or am I some way being, you know, is my self-aggrandizement? Is that what this is about? Who's being served? That's a question I ask myself. Who's being served by this action? Who's being served? In the dinners we have with the community, working dish team here. Hey, this is, I mean, it's like home being at home, because we serve about 150 people.
Only better organized.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And part of that is the blend between people being, you know, people who are the traditional receivers and people who are the traditional givers. So part of the deal is when you come to volunteer in these dinners, is everybody sits down together at the table to sit down dinner, so it's not kind of, you know, it's not served, you know, online. And a lot of people from the community have taken on more and more responsibility for preparation of the dinner and serving the dinner. So this blending is taking place between people who traditionally, you know, put themselves in the part of being the givers and people who traditionally put themselves in the part of being receivers. And so we're becoming more of a community where people have got different things to give and receive. And we get a better sense of how that works. So once in a while we'll get somebody up and say, we've got 20 volunteers here already. Nothing to do. I said, we can have dinner. Come to have dinner. I said, well, I'm not doing anything. We can have dinner. I mean, that's okay. I mean, that's what it's about. This time we're just going to have dinner together. And if there's nothing more to do, fantastic. I mean, let's. But it's because we have that kind of the agenda, you know, is, you know, I'm going to come here and do something for someone else. And, I've been talking a lot. Do you have any questions or comments or thoughts or sharings about your experience in this? In this way, and just kind of moving over from kind of the interior work, your prayer life, apart from as it plays itself out in your ministry. I know there are many people here involved in very helpful ministries.
After you have your day with your people, you find it, do you have some prayer time then in which you turn everything over to God and let go Or does it keep with you so that you can't let it go? Do you understand what I'm saying? Because I've worked in a situation and I've done my very, very best. I know I have. Maybe I could have done more. But the only way I could leave the situation is to say, God, I've done what I could. I have to trust that you will carry on so I don't hold a burden. Do you understand what I mean?
Oh, I sure do. Yeah.
And I think that's the only way I could at times leave, knowing that I leave the people I was with. So I didn't know if after you have had your day, then you have a little more time to reflect on God's promises to be with the people. And that doesn't say you're not going to go out the next day or anything like that, but to give you some of the rest that you might need to go in the next day.
Well, you know, I think sometimes yes and sometimes no. I mean, sometimes I've got the time to do that, and sometimes I don't. But what I find is, as after being involved in prayer for now for a number of years, what I'll do is I'll begin noticing, kind of ruminating about things. Or so even if I don't have a period of a set prayer time, what will come into awareness, I'm really obsessing about something, and I really try to give that to God and say, I've done what I can. And, but sometimes it's very difficult because again, part of the difficulty with this dance is there are people I really care about a lot who I've got so little ability to help better their lot. All I can do is be with them. Mm-hmm. And hope that they're going to make some steps. I mean, I'll give you an example. The day I thought about this guy until just now, the day that we were ready to leave, my colleague, there's two or two of this church. I'm here 40% time, and she's there full time. She does most of the preaching, and she just came back from vacation. And so I'm up in the church office, says, "You need to come down. There's somebody, there's one of your friends."
His friend.
Yeah, my friend, that's right. This is a guy who I kind of had peripheral contact with a number of times, and he had been panhandling and had some people had seen make a score, maybe $5 or something like that, and so they took it off of him, but then he got some more. I forgot how the story went, but he went down. And one of the things is in Chicago, I can't believe, this neighborhood is one of the most ethnically diverse neighborhoods that you'll ever see. Like, over 60 languages spoken in high school near where we used to live. But there's also a clan and a skinhead presence there. It's like, places where it isn't smart to be a skinhead is where you're outnumbered by folks, but there still is. And this guy is Jewish, and he had a very Jewish start. And so some skinheads just beat the noise out of him. And so I can say, he had his shoulder in sling. He just got kicked out of the hospital. They kind of fixed him up and kicked him out. And so he was there, and he was in a lot of pain. And so in the middle of the service, I saw this guy, and I really felt so sad for him. We talked, and then we had the service. He was fully in such misery that went out and we bought a prescription for him. Well, I got a prescription for him, which I hope that it was for Tylenol number 3, which I hope he doesn't deal on the street. No count.
Worth a long way.
Yep, it's worth a long way. And we had the script, and we needed it, and I figured, but he was very worried about being, he said, very vulnerable, because he had an arm in a sling, and we had to take the sling on and off a couple of times to get in and out of vehicles as well. So, I left him in front of a driving center. And my wish is that that guy wouldn't be physically disabled living on the street that night. But what I also know is that this guy burned himself out of about 5 different places over the last 6 months, and we've had contact only in crisis. And so one of the things I said to him, I said, please, when I get back in town, let's sit down and talk and try to look at getting some things going for yourself. or you're not in crisis. Because there's very little that I can do to help you right now. And all I can do is I can help this medicine, I can help get you down to this place that's relatively safe. But I know tonight when you're going to be in the streets, this guy's going to be vulnerable. Because he's an easy picking. So I mean, that guy sits back there, you know, and, mm-hmm. But again, you know, I kind of thought about coming out, and I kind of, because like, I mean, the question is how, who's being served by my remembering that over and over again? I mean, mm-hmm. I can't do anything for him, you know. I mean, I wish I could. I mean, it's, but when I go back, I'll try. I mean, it's not like the part is not that disengaging when it's need help to reengage, but if it keeps coming up, then he's not being served by it. Am I being served some perverse way? Maybe, I don't know. I don't know. But other
could I say one different thing about, maybe slightly different thing about it? Because I think partly your question is how do you maintain, you know, a level of activity when you're seeing people in pain and it's causing pain. And one of the things that I found in my life that was a benefit that I in no way expected of sitting in prayer was that it's in some way it's nurturing. You know, it gives you, somehow it fuels you. And I don't quite understand how that happens. But one of the things I noticed after we'd been sitting for a while is that at that time we were doing clinical work. And I'd always been the sort of psychologist who was very protective of my private time. You know, and I have this long lecture that I give my students about how if you're not taking care of yourself, you can't help anyone else, and so on and so forth. And when emergencies came up, I would, you know, be there and deal with them. But I'd always have the meter running, you know. Let's see now, my dinner is now an hour and 20 minutes late. How long is this going to go on, you know, kind of thing. And what I found after I started doing centering prayer on a fairly regular basis was that all of a sudden I wasn't doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. And if somebody needed to talk after 5:30, it's like, well, okay, here we are, we'll talk. You know, without having to have the meter run and having to figure out, well, now when am I going to make up this time mm-hmm. for myself? It's like somehow I didn't need as much mm-hmm. anymore. And I really don't understand how it works. But it does work that way. Or it did for me.
I got a question on mechanics. You mentioned that you wear a collar that serves as a shield. What about the women that go down there to work with you?
Some chosen to, some haven't.
I mean, a collar on a woman, anybody knows that that's not a breach. I mean,
yeah. Well, they just. They might also call the woman something else. I mean, part
usually sister.
Sisters, yeah.
In fact, I one of the surprises of my life was one day when we were working on Thanksgiving and feeding people and eating with people, somebody said, "Are you a nun?"
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you can't imagine how far this is from my self-image.
Well, it's really interesting because again, part of what happens when you're on the street is that people figure you got an agenda, and if they can't figure out what it is, it must be bad. Mm-hmm. And so, like you know, a lot of folks, you know, like one of the real cynical things that people say, "What costume shop did you buy your collar in?" Right? I mean, it's like you know, and that kind of thing, and the kind of it's like people can't deal with an authentic agenda. Mm-hmm. Because it's just too alien in some way. And so, but after a while, people did and do. And I mentioned earlier, when I was first in the street, people thought I was a narc, which is not a great reputation because bad things happen to narcs in the street. But after a while, people started calling me George the Hoodlum Priest. And I guess one guy asked me if I was a biker, and I said, well, I used to ride bikes and stuff like that. So I thought that was always cool. But it took about 6 months before people realized that I was there to stay. See, that's the other thing, too. And I know a lot of you who are here at Holden, I see the trans moving in and out and how to sustain community and caring in this kind of situation. It's very chaotic. This is a lot like Uptown in some ways. That sounds pretty kind of going. And so, look.
I don't know.
No, maybe not. Maybe not. That's right. No metal detectors thus far, anyway. No, that's good. But you know, what I'm saying is, I mean, that kind of, you know, it's like part of the thing was people say, you know, are you for real? Are you going to be around? Mm-hmm. And like there's a lot of anxiety with the folks that I'm with now since we moved our house down to, you know, we're now living near the seminary since I'm there a bit more. A lot of people were just convinced I wasn't going to be there anymore. I said, look, folks, I said, I'm going to be here at least for the next year and hope longer. I mean, I keep reassuring. But there was that sense of people being ripped off so many times. But I've been here 5 years now, so people realize that I've got some kind of a record. I have a hand back down here.
Yes. No, I think it's
I missed just the very beginning, but I just want to ask you, how exactly are you defining centering prayer? And because to me, in a sense, when I pray, I feel like I am centering. And the other thing I want to ask is, since you've been doing this contemplative prayer, has that affected your dream life at all? Have you seen any changes there? I was listening to a tape, I think yesterday here in the library, where the tape was about dreams and spirituality from a dream standpoint, and how much of our prayer is ego-based. I'm praying for this or that, or as it relates to our own ego, but that in dreams oftentimes there's a different level of spirituality that you're approaching. I'm wondering if that's been affected at all in this centering prayer, contemplative prayer. So there's two questions.
Okay. Well, the specific method is very simple. And the method is to come into silence with the intention to open yourself to the presence of God and to have a sacred word come to you that you can use over a period of time that signals your intention to continue to do so. I use the word logos because I love the Gospel of John, and so I use the word logos. That really is very meaningful to me. And so if I start being carried away by my thoughts, I think of the word logos, it kind of arises and I come back to the center, and then I'm not carried away by my thoughts so much anymore. And Keating talks about maybe doing that for about 20 minutes a day. But the idea is it's an opening. I mean, I think the method is an opening process. It's a process of going beyond words. It's listening to God rather than talking to God. It's a system. And again, and what happens is Thomas Bergman talked about, is we start kind of deconstructing the false self. And that's kind of what this chattering going on here is. This chattering going on all the time. It's kind of telling us who we are and what our story is and that kind of thing. And so bringing that a little more into awareness helps us to maybe not have it drive us quite so much. So that's the method. And I really, this book is a wonderful book. I highly recommend this. It's in the bookstore, I think, still Open Mind, Open Heart. And it's got lots of practical advice about how this works and what might happen and what might come up. In terms of dream work, I haven't really noticed any change in my dreams. I have very lively dreams, but I don't think they've changed much. So that's not what I see. Do you have any dream?
Well, actually, your question brings a thought to mind that I find myself having often these days. I really have to start paying attention to my dreams. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that my dreams have changed, but I don't do anything to pay attention to them, and by like 2 or 3 hours after I'm awake, I've usually forgotten. So
there are spiritual disciplines where you specifically try to induce intention to your dreams and try to have a specific agenda for your dreams that you dictate. Mm-hmm.
But also, I think just the process of remembering and thinking about your dreams can be spiritually constructed, you know, and can certainly both lead you in new ways and show you where you're going.
Yeah, one discipline I don't have yet is journaling the way I'd like to. And I think that's very much tied in with something, because really,
yeah.
I mean, it's something, I mean, I do journal, and I've kept a diary of the street work for the last 5 years, but oftentimes it's like 3 or 4 days afterwards, and I really want to have it be much more contemporaneous, but there's a...
You actually answered my question, but it dealt with the chattering, because I had a real difficult time with just being quiet and cutting the chatter, so you addressed it.
I journal my dreams, and I have found that I've had very significant dreams. And I also have a spiritual director that I meet with once a month, and he's very helpful in helping me to unravel some of the dreams. They're not all important dreams, but some have been very, very significant.
That's an important point too, folks. Don't do this at home. Don't try this at home. I mean, it really is important to have a soul friend using leeches, to have either formal spiritual direction relationship, to have a community of accountability and support that you're working with, because you can get lost really easily. And if you don't want to be grabbed by the Holy Spirit, don't start this stuff. I mean, because it's going to grab you, and so part of this, I think, is to kind of have a monitor, external monitor, and reflector is so helpful. So I really urge, it doesn't have to be a formal spiritual effort, but if you have a prayer group already in your church or a scripture study group that where people want to add another dimension, obviously hooking up with pastoral folks. Was there someone else over had a hand for a while also?
Yes. Just a comment and a question. Comment following on what you were saying about the importance of being there for the people that you're ministering to over the long haul. And I know, especially in urban ministry, I got involved in an urban parish about 6 years ago before we came to Holden. And the first thing, I went to a friend of mine who had been working with troubled youth for a long time, and he said, just right to my face, he said, don't get involved with those kids' lives unless you're willing to commit 5 years to it.
Yeah.
He said,
that's right.
He said, they've been let down too much, they've had too many fly-by-night kind of programs come through their community, and that's one of the biggest problems. But in regards to prayer, my question is, can you apply any of the principles of centering prayer and this to praying in groups or in public prayer or praying with someone else, but not in solitude? But can any of these principles be carried over to that? Have you experimented with that or seen that?
Well, praying in silence in a large group is extraordinarily powerful. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Quaker meetings.
Anabaptist tradition.
Oh, I mean, we were in a silent Quaker meeting where over a period of an hour and a half, maybe one or two folks kind of had that movement of the small, still voice. And it was extraordinarily powerful. At the seminary, we more recently, we've been doing this chanted prayer on a weekly basis. But for a while, and I teach a class called Practical Theology of Mysticism, which Nancy says is a triple oxymoron. but one of the things that we do in that class is we do seminary prayer together every class, and people covenant to engage in a spiritual practice, and it's not seminary prayer; it's something we mutually agree upon. Because it seems to me that if you're going to be looking at the theology of prayer, I think it's important that we bring back together the history, which were the folks who were writing the theology about prayer, where people were contemplatives for a long time, and not so much doing that together anymore. But yeah,
I think something if you read any of these authors, particularly the language sounds very ethereal and impractical at first, until you realize that they're talking about putting off self. One of the things they're talking about is turning off that internal monitor that chatters at you all the time about what happened yesterday, what's going to happen tomorrow, and it keeps you ruminating fruitlessly. And that's one of the blocks that almost all mystical writers talk about as being one of the prime things you got to do. And that's, but in a very practical way, that's something that gets in the way of being fruitful or creative.
I was going to mention that you mentioned the spiritual word, and possibly that would be creative openness for you. I think I would have difficulty with it, but I have a problem that I can create an openness, or the Lord will create an openness for me in using the, initially starting with the hymn, and it's usually the same hymn, and I will be able to lose that chatterness and get into prayer.
Well, that's right. This is not a, you know, this is a practical theology here, folks. I mean, so it's like, if that's helpful to you, you know, blessed be. I mean, that's wonderful because, and the chanted prayer we talked about this week, which is this overtone chant, is another way of stopping that internal dialogue. Now, the difficulty in some ways is, for me, maybe not for other people, is if I'm doing this chant prayer, it kind of just wipes everything out. I mean, it's just, I mean, that's it. I mean, the sound is there, and there's nothing else going on. I mean, it's kind of a suppression for me, rather than kind of a floating. And so this kind of internal monitor for me, then I don't have that internal monitoring function. And so it's very helpful. And again, there's some of you may know about the Jesus prayer, and there's a number of other kind of spoken prayers that are very helpful to bring people, you know, into quiet and into receptivity. You're right. And the other thing we say too is that that this isn't a substitute for, you know, for your reflection on Scripture, for your verbal prayer, for any other part of your devotional life. And many people find that kind of combining centering prayer with your usual devotional life is extraordinarily helpful in kind of figuring out how that fits. Some people say thought it would fit kind of going into like reflection on Scripture. It would be really helpful to kind of be kind of in a position of real opening and then open the text. Other people said they thought it might be really helpful to kind of use or be about scriptural reflection first as a way of kind of coming into this kind of place of abiding and then do it. But you know, there's no right or wrong here, I think. It's a matter of what really kind of speaks to you. We're all unique human beings. And so I think that's the message there. There's another hand over here.
I was just going to comment on what you said about that sort of second awareness. For me, the reintroduction to prayer has been trying to quit smoking and needing some extra help and really finding that that's the first time I've seriously and earnestly prayed for a long time. And my experience with what you call a second awareness has been more for me just an awareness of a relationship. If I have relationships with people and I don't communicate them and talk with them, their needs and their wants and their desires for me, as far as our relationship goes, basically go unheard. And so without conversation with God through silent prayer, for the longest time, God's wants and needs and desires for me, given whatever imagery you want for God, but my God's wants, desires, and needs for me have gone unheard by me because there's been no conversation. So that second awareness that, holy cow, do I ever want to smoke? That second awareness saying, no, you don't, to me is less than metaphorically the voice of God. You know, that second awareness isn't necessarily myself, but it's myself in conversation with God and understanding my call. And for the first time in a long time, I've understood the language where people say, I feel called by God to do this, and it depends on where God wants me to go. And I've always said, well, when did you talk with him? Because he sure doesn't talk to me. Well, I've never talked to him either. So there was no conversation going on.
I feel nudged a lot by God. You know, I mean, that's kind of, you know, it's like, it's kind of like this thing where Nancy and I talked a lot about this. It's like, we both love to live in a place like home. We live in a very rural part of Minnesota, so we dearly love the Lord. And, you know, but there aren't, there are all these doors opening to go be in the wilderness, but the doors continue to open to be in the city. And so that's kind of, I think, the same kind of thing. It's like, I think there's a message there. You know, it's like, whether you want to be here or not, this is where you're going to be. And we're kind of hanging out that way and seeing how it's going to unfold. Any other, we're almost out of time. We have another few minutes, another 3 or 4 minutes. Any other questions or comments?
Well, I was also going to say that I think the liturgy works within public worship the same way as Logos does for you, or a hymn may for Ted. For me, the LBW liturgy is something I've done my entire life, can do without thinking about it, and it's that same sort of mantra-like opening. Or by the time we roll around to the sermon, by the time we roll around to the real, I'll say meat. That may be not the correct thing to say here at Holden, but the meat of this
service. A veggie burger of the
service. Yeah, a veggie burger of the service. The liturgy has served that same purpose for me, and I think that we neglect in our services anymore, a lot, not necessarily here at Holden, but in a lot of practice, we're looking away from the liturgy, and I think that leads us away, and I may be being kind of orthodox, but leads us away from that centering that we need in order to then have a conversation. You know?
Well, that's what the liturgy is supposed to do.
That's what's supposed to do. Exactly.
No, but there's a lot of people who are wanting to get away from the liturgy.
Precisely.
You know, and
they're shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, and I think the point, there's another point here too, again, as a practical, I think he's an experimental theologian, okay? Well, you know, some people think, you know, it's kind of, do liturgy, it works. I mean, it's automatically, it's like, one of these drives me crazy is people, one of the terms is, now we're going to have fellowship? I mean, now we're going to have fellowship. It's like, oh yeah? I've been here before, just say fellowship, folks. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of, and so the thing is I think you're right. When we engage in certain communal worship practices and the Spirit moves us, I mean, that's worship. I mean, if we do these kind of practices and the Spirit does move us, I mean, isn't it? I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is tricky because what I know is sometimes centering prayer is very average. Nothing happens, folks. I mean, it's kind of like you're sitting there, and it's like, and it doesn't, if you have a lot of chatter one day, no chatter, that doesn't mean it's good or bad. The important thing is to continue doing it. So as a part of me, it says, I mean, you know, it's important to continue doing worship, whether it's maybe, really grabbing each time or not. That being said, I think it's also really important for us to attend to how worship predisposes us in our lives otherwise. That's the key here, I think, in terms of the message that the more I thought about this last 2 weeks, is that this is if our religious practices predispose ourselves to open our hearts, then I think we're really, we're on the right track. If it doesn't, then we need to kind of look at what we're doing together and figure out if we do some things differently. That's a wonderful example.
I wonder if we're straying from that. You know, it's my only question on in public worship together, where we worship as a community, how much we're straying from that time that we need to say, we are here as a community, let's center ourselves on our objective for worship. And I'm not saying that the liturgy is what works for me, but I'm wondering whether in sort of contemporary, I'll say Lutheran, because that's my background, worship practices, we're straying from that. I know my church has one service where we don't have a liturgy. No, we don't do it. And I agree with you that that's...
Well, we were talking at dinner that there used to be a Compline service frequently late at night in previous years here. Late, it would be like 10:30 or something like that. And it was always straight out of the book. It was never, whereas the earlier service would often be, as it is now, different every time we did it. The accompanying service, which is much quieter, was always the brief prayer service straight out of the Old Testament.